Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, working to assure opportunities for successful employment for all people with disabilities. A skilled workforce for Florida's businesses. The Able Trust. Empowerment, education, employment. On the web at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Families of Floridians with disabilities breathe a sigh of relief as a judge okays the iBudget.
I can do that with the iBudget. I couldn't do it before because everything had to be pre-approved so far in advance. And this has just come up and it needs to be done now.
Florida spends $600 million a year on its public defenders and state attorneys, but the heads of those offices say that's not enough to buy good lawyers.
If this keeps up much longer, state attorneys and public defender offices will become nothing but employees who have wealthy parents.
When you sell a shirt with someone's face on it, that can be lucrative. But what if the person in question was at the center of a controversial trial? Also this week, a lawmaker pushes for better motor voter law enforcement, and low-income Floridians struggle with a cut to the state's welfare transition program. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. This is Capitol Report. We start tonight with some late breaking news. Tallahassee Police Chief Dennis Jones is retiring. That announcement comes just days after officials released footage showing TPD officers using what some call excessive force on an intoxicated woman who was being arrested. Jones says the move to retire is not about the scandal. He says he wants to spend more time with his family. But the mishandling of the 44-year-old who was driving under the influence is the latest in a number of scandals that have plagued the department since Jones became chief 6 years ago. TPD spokesman Dave Northway says the most recent one weighed heavily in Jones's decision to step down.
Chief Jones did say that it was part of his decision. Obviously it's going on right now, but it was not the reason that he's deciding to retire. He has just decided that he was going to retire at this point. He knows it is going on. It is an issue that's plaguing Tallahassee at this point.
Jones's last day on the job is slated for October 5th. The city is in the process of looking for a replacement. Florida's Agency for Persons with Disabilities has won a lawsuit challenging its budgeting process. As Lynn Hatter reports, an administrative law judge this week upheld the legality of iBudget, and agency officials say it's time to move on.
The Agency for Persons with Disabilities has a fixed amount of money it can dole out, and that money is used to fund support services for those it serves to stay in their homes and with their families. The agency uses a system called the iBudget to allocate that cash, but it was challenged by a group of people who claimed the algorithm used to crunch the numbers was inaccurate. And Jim Freivogel, a former agency official who now heads the McDonald Training Center in Tampa, says what started as a noble attempt to find a fair way to allocate Medicaid dollars was corrupted.
As conceived, the individual budgeting concept is really a noble attempt to efficiently and effectively fund service needs for individuals. But as implemented, is really nothing more than a methodology employed by APD to ration services for the sole purpose of backing into its legislative appropriation.
Freivogel's main complaint with the iBudget is that it doesn't treat people with the same disability equally. The system starts with a base funding number and then relies on individual assessments to move that number up or down. That means two people with the same disability can get different amounts of money. But APD Director Barbara Palmer says the system is supposed to work that way. Take her hypothetical example of Billy and Jane, two children with cerebral palsy.
Billy over here has two parents that both work. He has siblings that are 16 or over that help after school. They have many community supports, and $30,000 is perfect to keep him out of an institution, to give them the other kinds of services that they need, the wraparound services. But then they go to Jane's house, and Jane has a single-parent mother who's working part-time, two siblings under age 6, and has her ailing mother with her who is dying.
While both children have the same disability, Jane would get more money. iBudget has been credited with helping the agency control its finances after years of deficits. Supporters say it's helped them budget better, too.
It means that we know how much money we have each year, and we know what her needs are, and we know we can sort of budget that money according to her needs.
Lou Ogburn chairs the North Florida Family Care Council and has a 48-year-old disabled daughter. She says iBudget is the best system the agency has used to allocate funding. For Ogburn, the big allure is the flexibility. While funding may be less, there are no restrictions on which services can be used or when. Right now, the big issue facing Ogburn's family is the need for a job coach for her daughter.
Because everything had to be pre-approved so far in advance. And this has just come up, and it needs to be done now. And I can make that decision now that we start looking at putting this program in place temporarily. We don't need it for long. We just need to make sure the transition occurs.
Ogburn says she believes much of the criticism is born out of a fear of change, and agency director Barbara Palmer agrees. She says the agency has spent so much time fighting lawsuits, it's hampered APD's ability to do much else.
Because our core mission is to serve the people in the best possible way, not to spend our time in depositions, which is what some of our key players here have had to do for weeks at a time. And you can tell I get frustrated with that because I feel very passionately about putting this system together. I always try to work with a sense of urgency because if it was my child, I'd want somebody to work with a sense of urgency for me.
Attorneys for the group who brought the challenge say they haven't decided whether to continue the legal fight, but Palmer says she's expecting another lawsuit. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
If you can't afford a lawyer in Florida, as in the rest of the country, you get assigned one, often a public defender. But when public defenders go up against state attorneys, is it a fair fight? As Regan McCarthy reports, the amount of money spent by the state on each side of the ledger is anything but equal.
This year, the state appropriated about $600 million to pay for the overhead cost and salaries of nearly 9,000 employees who work in public defenders or state attorney's offices in Florida's 20 judicial circuits. Each office also gets an allocation for what's called a due process fund. That's the pot of money used to pay for expert witnesses and DNA work or other evidentiary parts of a case. But Broward County Public Defender Howard Finkelstein says that's nowhere near enough.
In the 1960s, during the Cold War, there was a concept called mutually assured self-destruction. And what that meant was we would not shoot atomic bombs at Russia because they would shoot them at us. Well, we have the same sort of rationale going on here.
Finkelstein says because of budget constraints, the salary he can offer to the lawyers who work for him is limited. And he says that's also true for the state attorney's office. And what that means, he says, is both offices have young, inexperienced, overworked attorneys.
That is another equation for disaster. You do not want to build a criminal justice system that has a check and a balance of, oh, okay, well, the public defender is so inexperienced and maybe incompetent, but it's okay because the prosecutor is just as inexperienced and maybe just as incompetent.
Finkelstein says lately his office has been winning quite a few cases. Why? He says it's because his young public defenders are better trained than the young state attorneys. And he says that's because of the training program he uses in his office. Right now, about 140 lawyers work in Finkelstein's office, but between 30 and 40 of them are going through the training program he's created. He's dedicated two experienced attorneys in his office to oversee them, but that presents him with a catch-22. Train the young lawyers or have the experienced ones do the time in court so there isn't a backlog.
It can't all be about whittling the case numbers down, but having a whole bunch of people that may be bright-eyed and bushy-tailed but don't know nothing about nothing.
But Finkelstein says after he's invested time in training a young lawyer, it's usually not long before he or she is moving to another job in the private sector with better pay. Finkelstein says his small budget means he has to keep salaries low. So besides personal fulfillment for acting as a public servant, there's not much else to encourage his workers to stick around. Nearly 400 miles away, in one of the state's smallest judicial circuits in Live Oak, things don't seem all that different.
My name is Blair Payne, and I'm the public defender for the 3rd Judicial Circuit of Florida.
Payne's office employs just 31 people, but he's got a smaller budget as a result, which leaves him, just like Finkelstein, with lawyers just out of school. Payne says he's doing his best to, in his words, make a silk purse out of a sow's ear.
And then all of a sudden, they've been there a year and a half, 2 years, and they're constantly looking for other opportunities.
But even if you get past the staffing challenges, there are geographical ones.
I have about 1% of the population of Florida, but I have 7 counties.
That's Live Oak State Attorney Jeff Siegmeister, who says his biggest problem is finding a way to put a person in each of the communities he's supposed to serve.
I have an attorney assigned to Lafayette County, the smallest county. However, I can't afford to have a full-time secretary and a receptionist and an office space in Mayo to answer to those people.
And Siegmeister says he doesn't like the way his budget concerns affect the job he does. He says he and state attorneys around Florida are expected to raise a portion of their budgets through grants, their share of the money the community takes in from traffic tickets, and other sources.
Our goal should be justice, where we are only prosecuting those that justice dictates we should. We're expending the funds when necessary. We don't cut someone short of victims' rights because it's cheaper. But by the same token, we now put a dollar sign. You know, we have a vested interest in raising money.
And Siegmeister says being a good steward of the people's money means paying attention to his own budget and sometimes to Blair Payne's.
He shouldn't lose because we don't fund his experts. I shouldn't win or give up because it costs too much. But those are side effects of our decisions. So personally, I do consider the cost.
And while Siegmeister says that can't be the only factor he's considering, it causes him to think twice about death penalty cases, which are often more expensive to try. Typically, public defenders' budgets are quite a bit smaller than state attorneys' budgets. In fact, the Florida Legislature's Office of Program Policy Analysis and Government Accountability says public defenders got less than half the cash that state attorneys did in the current state budget. But House Criminal Justice Appropriations Chair Charles McBurney says that's not what he's thinking about when he helps draft the numbers.
I will ask them, what are your needs for the upcoming year and why? And then just dig down into the details and figure out why. I'm not focused in on the ratio so much as I am the functionality of what needs to be done.
As an ex-prosecutor, McBurney says he knows from firsthand experience there's no way the state will ever be able to compete with the salaries the private sector offers. But he suggests some of the state's expected surplus could be directed to public defenders or state attorneys. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
You too can join the conversation here on Capitol Report. Follow us on Twitter at @FPRCapReport. Filling in for Tom Flanagan, I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Still to come on Capitol Report. Smile for your photo? Check. Organ donor? Check. So what question sometimes isn't being asked of people who are getting their driver's license?
The last thing I think people are sometimes thinking about is whether or not they want to register to vote. So, you know, this takes some of that out of the process. I mean, if you're an American citizen, you should just be registered to vote. You shouldn't have to jump through all kinds of other hoops.
And after a budget cut this year, Florida's workforce boards are cutting services to those trying not to need welfare.
People are not able to go to work. Therefore, they will sit home and collect welfare benefits.
Florida's regional workforce boards help connect employers with workers. In addition to providing career training, the boards are also charged with helping transition people from getting federal public assistance to becoming self-sufficient. But as Jessica Palumbo reports, this year's state budget cut the welfare transition program, and that's making it harder for the boards to serve people with the lowest incomes.
Yolanda Brooks lives in Miami. She says after she was laid off in February from her job at the nonprofit Youth Services International, it got really hard to support her children and pay the bills.
I've even found myself being without any power electric for almost a week.
And she says that was with her federal TANF money. That's temporary assistance for needy families. To get help with her job search, Brooks went to a career training center run by the South Florida Workforce Investment Board.
I mean, I even have a specific person, David Gilbert. I mean, without him, I know for sure I would have been homeless. Homeless and stressed out with two kids living in a shelter.
For tens of thousands of people every month, Florida's 24 regional workforce boards help with training, finding job leads, and placing them in career shadowing so they can learn skills. Most funding for career centers comes from the federal government. But for families earning up to 185% of the federal poverty level before taxes, the centers use so-called welfare transition dollars from the state to provide additional support, including child care.
For a lot of people that I know that are on TANF, that is a big, big problem, daycare. And without daycare, they can't get a job.
This year, the legislature cut the workforce board's welfare transition budget by $15 million. That's 25% less than it was last year.
That was helping to pay for people to get to and from work.
Jim McShane is CEO of Workforce Plus, which is the workforce board for Leon, Gadsden, and Wakulla counties. Directors here recently looked at whether they could continue providing gas cards and bus passes for welfare transition clients. They chose to wait and see whether funding is restored during the upcoming legislative session before they decide. McShane says when boards stop providing welfare transition services, the number of clients participating in the program could drop below federally required minimums, and that could lead to even more funding lost.
One of the things we don't think the legislature has considered is the fact that these dollars will probably affect the federal dollars next year and reduce the state's funding in the whole welfare side by $45 million.
McShane says workforce boards could not take that cut after a decade of flat or decreasing federal budgets without reducing services.
The whole idea of welfare to work back in the year 2001 when it started was to get people off of sitting at home and getting a check and getting them into work.
That's a top priority for Florida Governor Rick Scott. In Jacksonville, recently talking with reporters, it came up again and again.
Jobs in our state, jobs, jobs, more jobs. What's going to help job creation?
But some regional workforce board directors say they have no choice but to cut welfare transition services. Workforce Central Florida Program Director Joyce Hinton says she's laid off 15 caseworkers since July.
Their job primarily was, you know, mapping out an employment plan, processing people who maybe wanted to go to post-secondary education, or assisting those job seekers that were ready to reenter back into the workforce, so helping them look for work, doing their resumes.
Hinton says the state has given career centers an automated, streamlined check-in process to replace the laid-off employees. That means welfare transition clients enter information into a computer instead of talking to a caseworker. In Miami, Yolanda Brooks says her support services have been a lifesaver. Without a car, bus passes from her workforce board are how she gets to job interviews. And she says the nonprofit where she's been career shadowing just told her they'd hire her full-time if they get a federal grant next month. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jessica Palumbo.
If you've renewed your driver's license lately, it's possible you were asked whether you wanted to register to vote as well. Some lawmakers say, though, that doesn't always get asked. One state lawmaker is hoping to legislatively pursue an effort to automatically register Florida voters when they get their driver's license. As Sasha Cordner reports, while some say it could make for a more efficient voter registration process, there are others who wonder if there could be negative impacts as well.
Ticket number 76, station 2. Last call, number 76.
Renee Bordeaux is about to get her name changed on her new Florida driver's license at the Leon County Tax Collector's Office.
Hold on, let me go back.
Is it anything worth it in keeping?
Yeah,
your signature. And remember to sign your new name.
Is the picture worth it?
Yes.
Okay. New name.
She's asked several different questions, including whether she'd like to be an organ donor and whether she'd like to register to vote in the county. That second question is required by law, and Leon County customer service rep Courtney Woodward says it's typically asked when a new name like Bordeaux's is entered into their database.
That kind of comes later on when you get through different questions. Are you currently registered to vote in the state of Florida? Yes. Is everything current? Do you change your address? Whatnot?
But University of Florida political scientist Daniel Smith says there's no standard across the state for DMV officials to implement what's called the motor voter law, and it varies by location.
You know, I was talking about this in my class yesterday, and, you know, some people were shocked that, you know, they could have registered at the DMV. They weren't aware of it. Others, the DMVs were more, you know, street-level bureaucrats who make that discretion of whether or not they're going to offer you to register or not.
He says a bill recently filed by Lake Worth Democratic Senator Jeff Clemens aiming to strengthen the law by automatically registering residents could create a consistent standard, but it may turn into a partisan issue despite what studies show.
The fact of the matter is that when motor voter was originally put into place, Republicans were concerned that this was going to get all these unwashed masses of Democrats registered. And the fact of the matter is it wasn't. It actually had a bump net plus for Republicans registering at DMV offices. So it shouldn't be a partisan issue, but I suspect it will, you know, once again boil down to that.
Clemens says he filed the measure mainly to get rid of what he calls, quote, an archaic voter registration system that seeks to disenfranchise minority and female voters. He adds the bill may also free county supervisors from taking part in voter registration drives, thereby allowing them to focus more on other areas.
Campaign to register voters is a fantastic thing. But really, we shouldn't have to have that. You know, supervisors will be able to concentrate on the things that they need to worry about, the elections themselves. Now, we will have more people on the voter rolls, so that, you know, that will require, obviously, a little bit more attention. But there'll be a lot less controversy about who's registered and who's not.
Meanwhile, Lori Edwards urges caution. She's the Polk County Election Supervisor and President of the Florida Election Supervisors Association. Edwards says DMV officials would still need to screen out certain groups of people, including convicted felons who can get a driver's license in Florida but can't vote.
And that information might not always be apparent to the people at the driver's license bureau. So we really have to try to be careful to find a way around that. And to update your address with the elections office is a free and easy process. However, to update your address with the driver's license bureau, it actually costs money. And as a result, that can be a deterrent. So certainly, I think that the supervisors are always happy to work in cooperation and partnership with the Division of Motor Vehicles. But I don't see that they would ever be taking the place of the work that we're doing.
Under Clemens' bill, those who do not want to be registered can also opt out of the automatic voter registration. It's the second time Clemens has filed the bill, and he hopes this year it'll get a hearing. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Kortner.
And lastly today, walk through any mall in Florida, or many in the country for that matter. You're likely to see T-shirts that feature your favorite Hollywood heroes. And in some cases, those celebrities are perched on the racks next to the image of slain Florida teen Trayvon Martin. Ryan Benk reports some call the sale of Martin's image profiteering. Others, though, say it's a legal form of tribute.
On the east side of Tallahassee Mall, just past the food court, stands a little urban clothing store called Top Fashion. and it's a weekday morning, and the mall is almost vacant. Store owner Bonnie Harsaney mans the register while one of her employees restocks some of the store shelves. Bonnie's been in business for about a year.
It takes a year just by now start people know me, got to know this town, you know, try to survive.
She says after building relationships with her customers, they started to ask for a particular type of merchandise.
Customer come down request, I like to have some Tremont shirt, and they want a certain style with the clothes. So you have to meet the people in town.
But not everybody sees it as simple supply and demand. Phil Agnew, whose group the Dream Defenders occupied the Florida Capitol for a month after George Zimmerman was acquitted of the charges relating to Martin's shooting death, says retail stores selling shirts with the teen's image are profiting from tragedy.
I think that if the family has not been consulted and the design and the shirt been approved by the family and the likeness been approved and the revenue from those shirts is not going back to the family or to the foundation that they've set up, then it's sheer profiteering. It's capitalism at its worst.
Still, patrons may disagree. Harsaney says the shirts have been popular, and shopper Tiffany Brown, who says she's a frequent Top Fashion patron, says she doesn't understand what the big deal is.
I mean, me personally, I actually feel like it's okay because it's basically just showing respect, you know, like,
yeah,
legacy live on, you know, everybody rocking Trayvon Martin shirt.
But is selling the shirt legal if the shop doesn't first get the family's okay? Tampa Bay intellectual property lawyer David Ellis says it depends.
Well, in Florida, there's actually a statute that says that no one can use another person's name or likeness or portrait or photograph for purposes of trade or any commercial or advertising purposes without the consent of the individual.
But according to Florida law, unless a person is married or has children, the right to their image doesn't get passed on to anyone. Ellis says that's why retail stores are fully within their right when they reproduce merchandise featuring Martin.
There would be nothing to prevent them from using his name and likeness for commercial purposes. It doesn't seem to me that the statute would cover this situation at all, because he neither had a widow nor children, nor had licensed his name or likeness during his lifetime.
Ellis says the family can't do anything about the merchandise already sold. But he says if the family trademarks his image or proves they own the photographs being used, the family could stop stores from further using their son's image. The Martin family could not be reached for comment. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Ryan Bank.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Ryan Bank, Sasha Cordner, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Jessica Palumbo. Thanks as well to the rest of our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox. Filling in for Tom Flanagan, I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Please do follow us on Twitter. That handle is FPRCapReport. And join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, committed to helping high school students with disabilities graduate and advance to jobs, post-secondary education, and a bright future. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment, on the web at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.